This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. Last Monday, as you'll recall, was the 4th of July, and while many of us had our eyes on the skies for fireworks, a team of planetary scientists had their eyes cast a little further out to Jupiter, where a new space probe Juno was about to arrive. Here to talk about that and other short subjects in science is Rachel Feltman, editor of the Washington Post's Speaking of Science blog. Welcome back, Rachel.
Thanks for having me, Ira.
The big story from the late 4th of July was Juno arriving at Jupiter, right?
Yes, it was a really impressive arrival. When you think about it, this was a spacecraft that was going upwards of 125,000 miles per hour as it approached the orbit. It needed to hit a target just a few miles wide within a span of just a few seconds to get the optimal orbit to, you know, carry out the scientific mission that they had planned. And it hit within 1 second and 1 centimeter of the target, which is just like very, very exciting.
Pretty good shooting.
Yeah, pretty good. I did have some people say, like, well, it was late and off target. But, you know, I think they did pretty well. So, now we have to wait until around the end of August, the next time the probe is really close to Jupiter, and it'll start, you know, really collecting data in earnest. But they did collect some data before they turned off the instruments in anticipation of the orbital entry. So NASA has said that they're already starting to comb through that, and there's a chance they'll find something interesting even before the big data dump begins.
Wow. A lot of planetary science this week. Another favorite, the New Horizons mission that visited Pluto has got a new place to head, right?
Yeah, which is actually part of the same program that Juno is, the same NASA program. And as everyone remembers, last year, New Horizons flew by the Pluto system. And ever since, the mission team has been working on redirecting it towards a new target out farther in the Kuiper Belt, this even more mysterious object. And NASA has just officially extended the funding so that they'll definitely be able to make it there. And it's supposed to reach, I think, on New Year's Day 2019. So that'll be another very exciting space holiday.
Yeah, because they say Pluto is just another piece of the Kuiper Belt.
Yeah. There's a lot of stuff to explore out there. And there were a couple other exciting mission extensions. Opportunity was extended yet again. It's more than 12 years old
now. The Mars rover.
Yes. It was supposed to last 3 months, and it's more than 12 years old.
No sign of stopping.
And Dawn, which orbited Vesta and Ceres, was extended, which apparently was, you know, nobody anticipated a year ago that the spacecraft would last. They actually considered sending it to orbit a third body, but decided that they would get more out of staying around Ceres. But that mission has been extended too.
And tell everybody what Ceres is.
Ceres is a dwarf planet. You know, it's one of the many bodies in the solar system that helped get Pluto demoted.
Well, but planetologists don't consider Pluto demoted. So
no.
There's a
little debate. Dwarf planet is just another thing. It's not a lesser thing.
Okay. Well, while we're out there in the solar system, there's a study this week talking about the potential for life on Titan.
Yes. So Titan is one of Saturn's moons.
And the biggest, right?
Yes. Hence the name. And it's a really exciting moon. It has the only stable liquid on the surface of anything other than Earth in the solar system that we know of. It has lakes and rivers and oceans, but they're all full of methane instead of water. It has this really thick atmosphere, but it's, very different from our own. And there's a lot of hydrogen cyanide produced in that atmosphere when the sunlight hits it. So these researchers basically modeled how hydrogen cyanide might act in the super cold environment of Titan. And they think that it might form this polymer called polymime that under Titan conditions, under Earth conditions, not a very exciting polymer, but under Titan's conditions, they think it might have some of the qualities that might make it an intriguing candidate for like a building block of life. You know, the way certain polymers helped create amino acids on early Earth. So they don't know this for sure. They haven't even modeled exactly how it happened, but it's an interesting look into, you know, how life might be completely unrecognizable to us on other planets, because when the conditions are so different, the chemistry that goes into life will be so different.
So they're not planning on a spacecraft going right now?
Well, I mean, there are no immediate plans in the works, but I mean, I know of a lot of planetary scientists who would love to see us go to Titan. And there is the Europa mission coming up, or tentatively coming up in the 2020s. And, you know, that's a slightly different world because it's a subsurface ocean, but it's a very similar idea that, you know, these moons with oceans on them are probably really great places to look for life.
And Enceladus, too,
yes.
Right? And Jupiter's.
And Ganymede is thought to have an ocean under its surface. There are so many moons that we should be going to.
You know, I remember I was talking to Alan Stern, who was the head of a lot of planetary science at NASA, and he said, Earth is the outlier in the solar system because we have our ocean on the outside.
Yeah, it really is. But Titan has an ocean on the outside, too, so we should
probably... But it's not a water ocean, right?
No. It's methane.
All right. Let's talk about bring it back home a little more. You wrote about the surprising, adorable thing that goats, I'm not making this up, folks, goats and puppies have in common.
Right. So there's this thing that dogs and horses are known to do, which is they use their gaze to communicate with humans, specifically for, basically, the best way to describe it is when a puppy wants something and they can't get to it, and they kind of look to you and look to the thing they want and look back to you and give you those puppy eyes, you know, they're trying to direct you with their gaze to help them. And it turns out that goats do this too, which is surprising in some ways and not surprising in others. It's been thought that this gaze behavior is related to domestication, and goats are some of the oldest domesticated animals. After dogs, they're the oldest we know of. They've been domesticated for about 11,000 years. So it makes sense that if it has to do with domestication, goats would have it. On the other hand, horses and dogs were both domesticated as companion animals, so it makes sense that they would learn to socialize with humans. Goats, on the other hand, were bred for meat and milk and their hair. So it's really interesting that they seem to have also learned to interact with humans in a positive way. And, you know, they're probably a lot smarter than most people give them credit for. And these researchers really want to better understand, you know, the mind of the goat.
So the goats will look at you and back at the thing just like a dog will.
Yeah, it's really cute. There's video of it. They will, you know, implore you to help them get treats.
Wow.
And apparently they do act very puppy-like. They'll, like, want you to scratch them. And
do you have one?
I don't have a goat.
It's tough in New York, though.
Yeah.
There are people who do, I'm sure.
Yes.
Rachel Feldman, as always, a pleasure to have you.
Thank you, Ira.
Rachel Feldman, editor of the Washington Post Speaking of Science blog. And now it's time to play Good Thing, Bad Thing. Because every story has a flip side. Should scientists have to ask for permission to study blood samples you gave at the doctor's office, or for a different study you already consented to years ago? Right now, they don't have to, but the Obama administration is proposing some new rules for how scientific research treats human subjects and these kinds of secondary uses of biospecimens. And under the proposed rules, researchers would have to get consent every time they reused your samples. What do scientists think? A report by the National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine is calling for the administration to scrap the proposal entirely and start over. Why would scientists be against more consent? Here with some insights is my guest, Holly Fernandez-Lynch, Executive Director of the Petrie Flom Center for Health Law Policy, Biotechnology, and Bioethics at Harvard Law School. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for having me.
So what is it exactly is the rule change the government is proposing?
So just as you explained, when there are leftover specimens, leftover from blood drawn at the doctor's office or leftover from research that you participated in previously, as long as those specimens don't have any identifiers about you still attached to them, researchers are currently allowed to use them for whatever purposes they would like without going back to you to get your consent. And what's being proposed to be changed now is saying it doesn't matter if those specimens have been de-identified, we're still going to require researchers to get your consent before using them.
So what's
go ahead.
Go ahead. I just wanted to know, so what's the good and the bad about this?
So the good, what the government has said in proposing this rule change is, well, people don't know how their specimens are being used, and if we fail to tell them, we're going to lose trust in the research enterprise. And trust is really important for the Cancer Moonshot and the Precision Medicine Initiative, and so we really ought to be telling people what we're doing with their specimens. So that's sort of the justification that's been put forth. The bad is a couple of things, in my view. One, what the government is proposing to require is not specific informed consent every time your samples get used over again. Instead, what they're proposing is broad consent at the time the specimen is collected, so that you would say to the patient, okay, we've collected this specimen. Whenever there's something left over, we're going to give it to researchers and they can do what they want with it. Now, that's not really so protective of individual autonomy, right? Because you don't know, as the patient, exactly how your specimens are going to be used. And so it doesn't, for people who think consent is important, the broad consent that's been proposed doesn't go far enough. The other problem with it from the scientist's perspective is that requiring consent in this way can actually be quite damaging to biospecimen research going forward, because it's not that easy to collect consent and track it going forward. It's going to be quite expensive to do that. There'll be all sorts of logistical concerns for institutions, and what for research institutions, and what may end up happening is that the institutions that are more poorly resourced are not going to ask consent. Instead, they're just going to say, forget it. We're not going to make those samples available for research. And that can end up biasing the samples that become available for research purposes going forward.
Is there a middle ground somewhere, something that you might suggest?
There is. So I actually sit on a government advisory panel. I'm not speaking on their behalf, but one of the things that we recommended was public education about how specimens are being used. It makes a lot of sense that people are confused. We're not telling them about this. And so, you know, we think that there's a responsibility for researchers and institutions to explain the value of biospecimen research, how low risk it is. And help people, you know, become aware of the social benefit of this research. That's one thing. Short of requiring actual consent would be an option to opt out of having your specimens be used if you're opposed to it. And then the last thing to do would be to punish people who are nefariously re-identifying specimens. That's something that's not currently part of the regulations or law, and it would be an important protection to add.
Thank you very much. Holly Fernandez-Lynch is at the Harvard Law School of Biotechnology and Bioethics. We're going to take a break and talk about space archaeology, how to protect those artifacts we left on the moon, right after this. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. You've probably heard about the space junk problem. In case you haven't, let me inform you that there are 500,000 fragments of man-made stuff flying by up there around the Earth in orbit. The junk is composed of everything from entire decommissioned spacecraft to nuts and bolts, and even tiny flecks of paint. China, which has blown up at least one satellite, creating a huge litter of junk, launched a test vehicle last week to try to clean up some of the mess. Don't know if that was related or not. But not all of the junk is trash. You know, one man's trash is another man's treasure. Landmark satellites float in this landfill. Remember Vanguard 1? It was launched in 1958, went dead in 1964. It is the oldest satellite still in space. Is it possible to preserve some of these historic artifacts in space? What about the landing sites, like the footprints on the moon, the flag, the moon buggies that are up there? And what makes something space trash or treasure? My next guests are here to talk about space archaeology, keeping track of all the human artifacts we've left in orbit and out in space. Beth O'Leary is Professor Emerita of Anthropology at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces. She joins us from KRWG. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Ann Darren is the Managing Executive of the Space Exploration Sector at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks, Ira. Happy to be here.
Yeah, happy to have you. And if you folks think there's a certain spacecraft or a landing site you think is important to preserve, we want to hear from you. Give us a call, 844-724-8255, 844-SciTalk. You can also tweet us at SciFry. Beth, let's talk about NASA keeps all kinds of schematics and models of all these satellites and landings. Give me the case for preserving all of these things. How is it different than anything else?
Well, material culture is very different. You know, archaeology is the study of the relationships between material culture, which are artifacts, and sometimes we think of junk, sites, and human behavior. So where they are, the actual physical manifestation of these things, is important to study the history of technology and certainly the history of space exploration. We tend to have a very great deal of material culture that's associated with space exploration. But we thought it was time to turn our gaze outward towards space and see what was up there and decide what is significant and what should be preserved.
And doesn't NORAD and NASA keep track of all those 500,000 objects we've sent up?
Well, certainly they keep track of them, but there's some that are significant, particularly of historical significance, and those are the ones we're really interested in. You know, for example, APL built NEAR. NEAR is the one that you mentioned was cruising out there. It's hitchhiking on an asteroid, and it's out there, and it comes around. It's in a Mars orbit, but it does come near Earth every so often, every so many years. And it's sitting there quietly enjoying its ride. It landed on Eros in 2001, and it's one of our favorite. But I love the idea of thinking about these historic, significant spacecraft that are out there.
So what's the plan, for example, for the moon? I mean, how do we preserve all those landing sites and all the artifacts that are up there?
Well, I think it's preserved now by the fact that it's so remote. We haven't visited it with any manned spacecraft in a long time. It's also pretty expensive to get there. But it lies in a very gray legal area because it's really governed by the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which didn't address historic preservation. They just wanted to get there. So it is preserved by its remoteness, by its cost to get there. But again, it falls into this area of, we will go back to the moon. I think both Ann and I think that. And so how do we decide which sites are important? I mean, I'd argue for Apollo 11 right off the bat, because that is the first lunar landing. And as an archaeologist, we're very concerned with the first landing of Columbus in the Caribbean, the first footprint, for example, in Laetoli, Tanzania, which is 1.6 million years old. Well, we've got a set of footprints up there that were made, you know, in July of 1969.
Would it be possible to capture, you know, I was talking about the Chinese spacecraft that was trying to clean up some of the junk in space. Would it be able to capture? I think it was in a James Bond movie. They sent the rocket up, and you remember that movie? And they captured a satellite. Would it be possible to capture Vanguard and bring it back? And would anybody pay for that?
Well, of course it would be possible. It's technologically possible. It is up a little bit high. It is in an elliptical orbit. It will at some point deorbit. But, you know, Beth can talk a little bit about trying to preserve things in situ as long as they're not doing any potential damage. And so Vanguard currently is beautifully preserved where it is. Because of its orbit, it definitely is possible. It's expensive. And a good question, is anybody going to pay to go get it?
Yeah, and I think, too, that really the preservation, you don't think of museums floating around on Earth, but very few museums have lasted 600 years or even 240 years. So that locational integrity, that orbit, in effect, is preserving it. And if you take it down, if you grab it somehow, I think you lose part of that extraordinary significance. And we also have models of Vanguard 1 in the Smithsonian.
Mm-hmm. Is it possible to bring some of the satellites down from orbit? You're saying that you'd rather leave them up there. Is there a place to park them, or we can all find them in one spot?
Oh, sure, certainly. There's something that's got a marvelous name of the graveyard orbit, and that's which is a great place. And actually, what you have in geosynchronous satellites and geostationary orbits is we require now, and this has been on since 2002 under FCC, that you actually push spacecraft up into a higher orbit, kind of a useless orbit in some manner, and that's about 500 kilometers above where they were. So we have a lot of commercial satellites up there in the graveyard floating around where they won't do any harm to anybody. We can certainly push satellites up, and you can actually, of course, deorbit satellites, and of course nature assists us with being able to deorbit satellites.
Let's talk about the NEAR. You mentioned in passing that the spacecraft is sitting on an asteroid. It was parked there.
Well, it was a fabulous story, and we're really fond of it here because, of course, it actually was launched in 1996, and it flew by an asteroid named Matilde. So we like to say waltzing by Matilda. But it went on to enter into orbit around the asteroid Eros on February 14th of 2000. What a great date to go into orbit around Eros. So Eros looks like an Idaho potato, if you can think of a 20-mile-long Idaho potato. So it went into orbit. So now we have a spacecraft that is now a satellite. It's an orbiter. And at the end of mission, everybody said, well, what are we going to do now? And someone said, well, why don't we just land it? So, of course, this was never built to be landed. It actually, we did bring it down onto this giant asteroid and landed it. We actually operated it for a while there. And that asteroid has given it a free ride. And it's in a nice elliptical. It does come around the Earth. You know, it was just here in about 2012. It was near enough to us. At some point, if we ever get into a grand tour of great spent spacecraft, perhaps we'll get pictures of it and see it again.
You know, that could be great space tourism, if you think about it.
Oh, I think the grand tour. You can get up there and see quite a few things. There's a lot on the moon to be seen, and certainly we've got some Mars mysteries of some of our little landers and why they don't work anymore, or why they stopped working prematurely.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the moon. I know that the Russians also sent quite a few probes to the moon, and are you not working on a project to find two of their landers, the Luna 9 and the 13?
Oh, yeah. I'm just, this is so much fun. So the Soviets, and of course we did the same, but the Soviets in the 60s and the 70s, they put many unmanned probes to the moon. And in 2009, NASA launched the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter. So we're up there taking really good surface pictures. And we found a few of the objects. We found Luna 16 and Luna 20. Dr. Jeff Plescia, who has been working with us, found two of them. But we're still missing a few. And they've been missing for 50 years. How exciting. I would love to find them. So what we're doing here at we have an Intelligence Systems Center. We are having a team. There is a contest. We have 45 engineers and scientists right now who are all in a contest to develop algorithms using machine learning to go through all of the images we're getting from LRO and find Luna 9 and Luna 13. So stay tuned. We hope we'll have good luck in a few months.
I'm good. I'm wishing you luck. We all like to see that. We all like, you know, all those places on the moon. Are the footprints still there? Are the flags still flying, so to speak, do you think?
As far as I know, they are. They may be changed in terms of the swings of temperature on the moon. But when the LRO images were first broadcast, the digital images, it was amazing. It's a great tool for archaeologists using remote sensing to look at archaeological sites and exactly what's up there.
I know that after Neil Armstrong died, tools from Apollo 11 were found in his closet. My question about this is, who owns this stuff? I mean, didn't we as taxpayers pay for it? Or is there some sort of agreement that astronauts can take some of the stuff home privately? I think whenever I hear and I see all these auctions going off of NASA material, that don't we own that stuff? I mean, shouldn't it be in public display somewhere instead of somebody's basement in a showcase someplace?
Can I address this one? Because he was my hero. I wanted to be an astronaut. And that's his personal archaeological collection. After his death, his wife gave it to the Smithsonian. So he had a McDivitt purse that was going to be jettisoned anyway, and a waist tether and a 16-millimeter digital camera. And that's all now with the Smithsonian. But I think the heroes, the astronauts that risked so much to get there, should be allowed to have a few things and come back. Though the big problem, of course, is the traffic on eBay and different sites, R&R auctions online, that auction off space material. And so NASA does retain rights to the things that they create. I think we should forgive Neil Armstrong for having them in his closet for a little while.
I didn't mean to single him out, but because there's so much junk being sold on eBay, space stuff, from doors and things, you know, parts of spacecraft that I think belong to the public. We paid for it, and we should see it and be able to see it, you know.
And it should still be there, Ira. You know, when space tourism happens, whether it's 50 years from now or 100 years from now, if we don't have some safeguards of how far away people can be or where they could go or where the rovers can go, we stand to lose that heritage. And we've lost a lot on Earth. So I think it's important that we think about now, what do we want these early space sites? Phil Stuck calls it the Lunar One era. How well do we want these to be in preservation, be preserved, so that in the future generations can visit and see them and study them?
Mm-hmm. And that which brings up a thought about what does a piece of space junk, I'll use that term for everything, orbiting look like? I mean, it's been up there 10, 20, 30, 40, 50 years. Isn't there space weatherification that happens to it?
Oh, there absolutely is. Of course, you've got the radiation effects, ionizing radiation. There's space. There's plasmas up there, especially in LEO. We have, the solar environment. You might run into micrometeoroids and different types of debris. There's in LEO. There's neutral gases. There's all sorts of things happening. So we can learn a lot by how our different spacecraft degrade. Mm-hmm. A good example is you mentioned Vanguard at the very beginning. Vanguard, when it first went up there, people started estimating, wow, it might be up there 2,000 years. But solar radiation pressure, atmospheric drag, the effects of space weather, of space, have really produced significant perturbations to the perigee. And so what we're seeing is a significant decrease in the lifetime. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of expecting it to come down closer to 240 years. But maybe we need to grab it before it reenters instead of letting it burn up.
I'm all for that.
It might be something really special.
I'm all for that. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI Public Radio International. Talking with Beth O'Leary from, she's professor of anthropology at New Mexico State University in Las Cruces, and Darren of Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. A tweet says, Carl Johnson wants to know, are there any living organisms? Could they be single-celled? I'm going to add plant, animals, on any of these satellites that might be worth studying? Now, you know, we sent up this stuff. I'm sure it wasn't totally free of this stuff, right? Wouldn't that be interesting and informative to learn about?
Well, it's a fascinating question, and of course, we do everything in our power to get these as clean as possible before they go up. So I can't really answer this. I'm not a space biologist, but we try to keep these things clean.
For example, on Surveyor 3, when the Apollo 12 astronauts, who are really the first space archaeologists, went over to look at it, they took a piece of tubing and a camera, and they found some Streptococcus bacteria that had been on there, put on there about a year and a half previous, and it looked like somebody might have sneezed before the Surveyor 3 went up. So they brought some of that back to Earth. But in terms of what's up there,
was it still viable? Was it still viable?
They could identify it, again, Anne and I are not space biologists.
Well, we've talked to other people who said that probably the Viking has been contaminated, that we brought already living things to Mars, and single celled stuff, and it's very interesting. So where do you go from here? How can you create something that brings to fruition space archaeology?
Well, NASA in 2011 went ahead and issued a series of guidelines, and that was a sea change from when I started in 2000 when I proposed to them to make the Apollo 11's lunar landing site a National Historic Landmark, and they said, no, I don't think so at all. And what they did was they came up with a series of recommendations. They used a panel of experts, physicists and engineers, myself, Roger Lanius from Smithsonian, and we wrote down really what people should do that come back to the moon to visit. And it was for commercial spacecraft and also for nations that come and visit the moon. And what they tried to do was look at the effects of landing on the moon, mostly robotics, and how that would affect the heritage objects, the important significant objects left on the moon. And they set aside Apollo 11, the first one, and Apollo 17, the last one, and said, within 2 kilometers, a radius of 2 kilometers, you can't even go there. So essentially, that is now in place from NASA, and there has been a buy-in by the different people involved in the Google X Prize to say,
wow.
Yeah, we're going to avoid those.
Landing-free zone. Well, this is quite fascinating. Thank you, Dr. Beth O'Leary, Professor Emerita of Anthropology, New Mexico State University, Las Cruces, and Dr. Ann Darin, Managing Executive of the Space Exploration Sector at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Laboratory. Have a great weekend.
Well, thank you very much. It's been a delight.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
We're going to take a break, and after the break, we're going to talk about how you can take a geological trip of the country from the air. This is something I do. I'm so eager for this. Looking out the window, how to see all the sights and what they mean. We'll be right back after this short break. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. I have been doing lots of traveling this year, but I hate the boredom of flying. But one thing that makes it all worthwhile is spotting something cool outside of the window down below, like the Grand Canyon or maybe Mount St. Helens, a giant wind farm. But being so high up, it can be hard to figure out what you're looking at. Well, my guest is here to help you out. She's co-creator of a new app called Flyover Country. The app is Flyover Country, and it pinpoints the geological features that you're flying over. Yes, and you can even track spots where dinosaur bones have been discovered. Ooh. Amy Mirbeau is a researcher in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much, Ira. I grew up watching you on Newton's Apple on KTCA in St. Paul.
Now you're dating me and yourself.
Are we dating now?
There you go.
Sorry.
Do you always try to get a window seat on a flight like I do?
Absolutely. I will push people out of the way to get that window seat.
You do. Well, I haven't gotten that bold yet, but I'm thinking about it. Do geologists study the ground this way? Is this a practical way to do it?
Absolutely. Before Google Earth, this is, you know, how we did it, right? We had some air photos and we could travel with those in our laps. But really, the window seat was the Google Earth of
wow.
the past.
Yeah.
And we really, it's an amazing view. And this is really what got us started thinking about how we could use that window seat as a great way to get people engaged with the geoscience.
Well, I can't wait I already downloaded the app. It's called, is it only on Flyover Country? Is it on both platforms or just?
That's right, both Android and iOS.
You can get it. I can't wait to start. And let me see. You start the app. You're up in the sky. And does the app follow you as you fly over stuff?
Well, so ideally, you would load your path while you're still on Wi-Fi on the ground. So what you would do is click on your the city of your departure and your destination. You could also click on multiple cities. Say if you were taking a road trip or a hike, there's a mode for that as well, so not just for flying. But you would click on your departure airport and your arrival airport and then say load path. Then the app will go out to a number of geoscience databases and pull down the information within sort of a strip of a couple hundred miles around your path. And then you can save that to your phone and you have it offline without buying in-flight Wi-Fi or without having data.
So how does it know where you are?
It uses your GPS, which is completely legitimate in airplane mode. We get that question a lot.
Wow. And, you know, so what are the easiest things to spot when you want to try this out first?
I would say the easiest things to spot are man-made features, right? We see center point irrigation and cropland and dams, but you know, and you can see what cities you're flying over. There are, of course, geologically a lot of fantastic things like volcanoes and glaciers and mountain ranges and huge rivers. But there are some maybe more subtle things that mm-hmm. I think the app can tell you about. I, of course, fly into, I live in Minneapolis and fly in there, in and out of there a lot. And I love thinking about, you know, when I get close to home and see all of those lakes and rivers and how, you know, 15,000 years ago, there was probably a half mile thick sheet of ice on top of the region. And that's why all those lakes and rivers are here. As the ice melted back, it left blocks of ice and gravel and dirt and garbage. And those finally melted out. And those are the thousands of lakes in the upper Midwest in the Great Lakes region.
What?
There are many other
wow.
things.
Yeah, well, one of those things that I love flying over are mountains and trying to figure out first which mountains I'm flying over.
Yeah.
And second, how the mountains were made. Does the app tell you anything about the geological history?
It does. So the databases that we're currently calling are one that gives you a geologic map that for each of the rock units, it tells you a little bit about it. That's from a resource in Madison, University of Wisconsin, called MacroStrat. It goes out to a couple of fossil databases, but our biggest source of information right now is actually Wikipedia. There's a huge amount of articles about physiographic features and geologic features on all over the world, really, because the app works worldwide. It's not just not just U.S. or North America, and those articles are, of course, of varying quality, but they tend to be pretty good, and they reference scientific literature and tell you a lot about the history and formation and connections mm-hmm. between that geology and somewhere else.
Can tell you all about the different river types that you're flying over?
Yeah, absolutely. We have a feature in there called What Is That? That we sort of absorbed from a researcher at Bryn Mawr, Selby Harth, and she did a lot of stuff with Google Maps images and sort of the basic geology, geomorphology of landforms. So different kinds of rivers, different formations of lakes, valleys and volcanoes and mountains and rifts and human-made features and things like that. So there's all sorts of cool stuff to entertain yourself with, as well as the things you're flying over.
And some of the most interesting things are when you see the terrain change from a mountain to a flat area, and you wonder, how did that happen?
Yeah, flying into Denver is one of the greatest examples of that. Or I flew into Albuquerque last week, and it was flat, 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 and then boom, there are mountains, and it gets pretty exciting.
You know what you should? I'm not going to tell you what to do, but I would make a suggestion: get it on the back seats of the the app. Load it into the video viewers that are already on the planes.
We would love that. Yeah. And you may see that in your future.
Whoa, that would be ultra cool.
Yep.
Can you find remnants of old lakes and things like that that used to be there?
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think is cool flying across the sort of the Great Lakes region in the upper Midwest. A lot of that landscape has been drained for agriculture over the last 100, 150 years. But especially when before and after the crops are on, so sort of spring, fall, winter, if you don't have a whole lot of snow, you can see a lot of patterning in the grounds. It's still there, right? The soil is different where there used to be a lake or a river, and there's a little bit of topography, but you can mostly see it in the colors and textures of the ground and sort of think back. You know, I'm a paleoscientist. I study cores from lakes, and so I love thinking about that long-term history of the landscape and really how human impacts have overprinted and interacted with that over more mm-hmm. recent times.
Let me see if I can get a phone call in. Let's go to Salt Lake. Keenan, hi, welcome to Science Friday.
Yeah, I'm wondering, so when I'm at altitude in an airplane, I'm looking down and I'm always seeing cloud cover. So I'm wondering, okay, so I could just be super unlucky, but it seems like once you go to that high an altitude, you are seeing mainly just the high altitude cloud covering. So how do you figure out exactly like a flight that's going to be at a low enough altitude, or are like flights over Oregon always going to just show nothing because of the rain?
You may be flying on those rainy days. No, it is true that that's a bummer. Sometimes if you fly over the West, it's cloudy all the way, and sometimes you get lucky. You can use in flyover country, you can look at a satellite map so you can see, you know, as if you were using Google Earth, see what's underneath those clouds. But you could also just enjoy the wonder of the clouds. We actually have a local Minneapolis-St. Paul climatologist and weather enthusiast who is working with us to write a description of what you can learn about clouds, different types of clouds, and what they say about weather patterns and the landscape below and why you shouldn't be freaked out by turbulence.
There you go. What about the man-made objects? Like I mentioned wind farms, but there are all kinds of things like mines and farms and stuff like that.
Yeah, golf courses are pretty easy to
especially see. Especially in Minnesota, right?
Excuse me. There are, you know, oil patches, dams. So in lots of parts of the state of the country that aren't as lucky as we are in Minnesota to have tons and tons of lakes, the only lakes are made by damming rivers, and those have a really specific shape, sort of flat at one end where the dam is.
And if you live on the coast where the oceans are, I mean...
Oh, my gosh, there's such beautiful coastal geomorphology, and it changes so quickly, right? We're... Humans are really trying, have to fight a really uphill battle to try to keep the coast, you know, keep towns and homes and roads and things where they are, close to the coast, because it's such a dynamic environment.
All right. Anne Mirbeau, thank you. Amy Mirbeau, thank you for taking time. I can't wait to get up on my next flight and try out the app. It's called Flyover Country. And
it is funded by the National Science Foundation. I would like to emphasize that. They have been wonderful and enthusiastic.
All right. Amy is a researcher in the Department of Earth Sciences at the University of Minnesota in Minneapolis. Thank you, Doctor, for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Ira.
Earlier this month, New York played host to an event that was a little bit art show, a little bit science fair, the Biodesign Summit. It was the culmination of a semester-long project for art and design students across the country. And our own Chow Tu and Luke Groskin stepped in. Science writer, web producer Chow Tu is here to tell us about it.
Hi, Ira.
Good to have you.
Good to see you.
So what was this event all about? Who was it for?
So it was basically a bunch of art and design students from around the country. And they came from schools like the School of the Art Institute of Chicago, FIT, Carnegie Mellon. And they were asked to create a product or a project that was heavily based in bioscience, to look forward into thinking about how biotechnology could affect our environment and our lives in the future. Mm-hmm. And so there were 9 finalists, and that's what this summit was sort of. These teams were showing off these projects.
Tell us what did they have to do, the same project, or everybody came up with their own project?
There were different themes that each team had to sort of think about. And so there was themes of water, sustainability, the environment. Mm-hmm. So each one of them had their own kind of challenge for themselves.
So then when you say bioscience, then anything having to do with living?
Yes, yeah, definitely. It's like there were lots of living things, including growing slime mold and
growing slime.
Yeah.
Well, they have that in Florida. A lot of that down there. Our video producer Luke Groskin got a chance to ask Biodesign Challenge Program Director Daniel Grushkin about the project, and here's what he said.
We are now in a culture where everything's about the pitch. You know, you go to an accelerator and they have a demo day, and it's all about sell, sell, sell. We're trying to do something very different. We're saying, think, think, think. The 3 goals of the challenge have been, 1, to create a community of scientists, designers, and artists who are all collaborating together. Inform the public about what the potentials of the technology might be. And 3 is, hey, let's see some fresh ideas in the space of biotechnology. Let's see what we can do.
So did you see a lot of those fresh ideas?
Yeah, they're very, very creative ideas. There was one team who created these air filter masks, and these wearables, really. So one of the ideas was, you have this mask, and there's a cartridge inside of it that uses spider webs. And that's based off research that spider webs have electrostatic properties that might be able to catch like microorganisms in the air, and that might kind of purify the air around you. There was also another idea about putting a liner in your toilet that can collect excess estrogen that was kind of being put into the wastewater, and that can later affect our health. So there were lots of creative ideas about how we can use science and solve problems in our environment.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from PRI, Public Radio International. Talking with our Science Friday web reporter, Chow Tu. You can read her article and see a video by Luke Groskin at sciencefriday.com/biodesign. Being at the convention, or is that what they called it? Just
a summit.
A summit.
Yes.
Much newer type of word. Did you have any of your favorites to say, wow, that was terrific?
Well, the team that actually won had a really interesting design. They were a team from FIT, so mostly
Fashion Institute?
Yes, Fashion Institute Technology. So again, students that were sort of interested in sustainability and fashion and textile like production. So they they started working with this thing called alginate, which comes from brown algae, and they created a sort of new yarn that it was sustainable and it stretched and kind of.
The algae made the yarn?
The algae made out of the.
Like, no, made out of the yarn. Huh?
Or, I'm sorry. The algae is the yarn, yes.
Wow. Sort of. That's yarn made out of algae.
Yes. So obviously.
And so what did they do with it?
So again, these are just kind of like creative, like these are just sort of the beginning phases of these ideas. There's still a lot of like sort of research, a lot of development that needs to be done. But it's a lot of creativity that comes from this.
Did they make a garment out of the yarn?
They did not. Not yet.
Not yet.
So yeah, but basically they kind of mixed it with water and different other sorts of chemicals to kind of see how they could stretch it and how they could work with it and later develop it into something that might be viable.
Well, did you see anything that was viable already? Anything practical?
One of the most practical projects that I saw was this panel that was based off of a cactus plant. So basically it had spikes that were modeled after cactus spines, and each of the cactus spines have grooves just like a normal cactus spine does, and that can collect water from fog in the air. And so they wanted to put that on the sides of buildings and hopefully collect enough water that we could use again.
So then they made the spines like a cactus
mm-hmm.
has, and
mm-hmm.
the idea is, well, we don't need to have just the cactus do this.
Yes.
We could put these spines on other things,
mm-hmm.
and then in the dew that forms...
Exactly. In the desert, there's a ton of morning fog, and it could collect that in the morning, and then we can hopefully use that water again.
Wow. People come. Was it a big turnout? People interested?
Yeah, it was great. It was a lot of creative ideas, and I think people were really excited about it. And just these students, I think, were thinking very differently, like kind of outside of the box of what they're usually used to,
mm-hmm.
and thinking about science and how to use that into stuff that we could use.
And your article on the website describes
yes.
your experience there.
Yes.
All right. Chow Tu is our Sci-Fry web reporter, and you can read her article and see the video by Luke Raskin, who brought all this stuff, video stuff out there at sciencefriday.com/biodesign. Thank you, Chow.
Hi, Ira.
We'll see you back in the office. Charles Berquist is our director. Our senior producer is Christopher Taliata. Our producers are Alexa Lim, Annie Minoff, and Christy Taylor. Luke Raskin is our video producer. Rich Kim is our technical director. Sarah Fishman and Jack Horowitz are our engineers at the controls here at the studios of our production partners, the City University of New York. If you missed any part of the program, I know a lot of people were having trouble finding us today because of what's going on in Dallas, and our hearts are with them out there. If you want to listen to it and you missed it, or your friends, send them over to our website at sciencefriday.com. where you can also join our mailing list and listen to the program at the same time. And on Facebook, if you like us, then like us on Facebook. And we're continuing a week-long discussion on Twitter at SciFry. And if you want to send us some mail, we like that too. Science Friday, 19 West 44th Street, room 412, New York, New York, 10036. Our address is SciFry@sciencefriday.com. I'm Ira Flatow in New York.